For the sailor, tide tables are a kind of Bible that order your comings and goings. And mostly sailors don't stop to marvel at the heavenly powers that move the waters, even when they study the moon and stars on night passages. Now there's a book, Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean, that melds science, history and travel notes to explain the mystery of the tides, how humans have experienced and explained them, and what rising seas might mean for our relationship with our watery planet in the future. Mariner Jonathan White was spurred to write the book when a tide caught him and his boat off guard.
Well, I was actually in my mid-20s around that time when I got that big old wooden schooner, 65 feet, and we used to sail up and down the coast from Seattle to Alaska. And on one particular trip, we anchored in a small bay, and a gale blew up in the night. And I got up and noticed that something was wrong. And indeed, we were aground at the end of the bay. We had dragged anchor.
And what happened?
Well, I've been aground before, and if the tide was low, the boat would have come up off the mud, and nobody would have even noticed. But as I studied the tide chart, I couldn't believe it because we were actually at the top of a high tide. And in Alaska, they have large tides. So what that meant was in the next 6 hours, the water would go down 12 feet and most of the water in this bay would disappear. The boat went down and got stuck in the mud. So when the water came up, it actually filled it with water. And by mid-morning, we were swimming through the boat. Everything started floating around. We had all provisions, fruit and cookies, and rice had swollen. We had a library of 300 books or so on the boat. And if you've ever seen a book swell with water, you know that it gets three times the size and the weight. And it's actually a formidable weapon at that point. Some of the ironic titles that floated by that morning, like Between Pacific Tides by Ed Ricketts, or How Can I Help by Ron Doss, or In Deep by Maxine Kuhman. It was quite funny at times.
Long story short, you did in the end manage to get off, and you actually managed to refloat the boat and even restart the engine. But you're hardly the only mariner to go aground, of course. In the early days of exploration, there are many, many mishaps.
Oh, goodness. Even Cook, in his explorations, went aground in Australia in a very famous grounding where the tide went out and left them high and dry. And, of course, they were used to very different tide regimes and didn't understand the dynamics of the tide in Australia, which was typical of those days. You know, they, people were familiar with what happened around where they lived. But once they went afar, they were quite often surprised. Where England, and actually here, has two tides a day, and in fact on the Atlantic coast as well, many, many places around the world have that. There are places like Tahiti that has one tide a day, and there are places that have four tides a day, and there are places that have six tides a day, and there are standing tides and double low tides and double high tides. So there are lots and lots of anomalies.
Well, we all learn in school that basically it's the moon's influence that makes the tides. So can you tell us how it is that the moon makes the tides happen?
Yes, I'll start by saying that it actually is the moon and the sun. But the moon, because it's so much closer, has about 50% more influence on tides. When the sun and the moon are working together, as they do during full moon and new moon, that's when we have our largest tides. But when the moon and the sun are at 90-degree angles to each other relative to the Earth, that's when the moon and the sun are working against each other, and we have the lower tides, called the neap tides. So when the moon is overhead and full, it's creating a bulge in the Earth's oceans underneath it, and we are actually spinning underneath that bulge. That's really how it works. There's a bulge facing the moon, and then there's another bulge on the opposite side of the Earth that's created by centrifugal force, which is the force that we all experience when we come around a swerve driving, and what we feel is that car wants to straighten out or flip over, right? Well, that's generally why we have two tides a day.
You spoke about the Earth spinning, and indeed, as well as the sun's influence, there are also influences of more weird phenomena, like the fact that the Earth wobbles on its axis, and obviously at some stages the moon is closer to us and some stages it's further away, and all these play into the tides, which is why it becomes so complicated.
Yes, that's right. It's important to remember that everything is moving, and there's a gravitational relationship between all these parts. In general, there are over 400 of these relationships that affect the tide.
Wow. you made me familiar with some wonderful words like perihelion and perigee, and my favorite of all is this word syzygy, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, syzygy. It's wonderful.
Yes, it's a great Scrabble word. It's a Greek word meaning yoked together, and it describes when the earth, moon, and sun are aligned. So when we have our largest tides, it's usually because the earth, moon, and sun are aligned, and that's called syzygy.
It's a great word. You write about the vast differences in height between low and high tide, in some places as much as 54 feet, yet the discrepancy is only about a couple of feet in, say, the Mediterranean. How does that come about?
Well, the tide is a lot of different things, but you can boil it down to vibration and resonance, more particularly. And resonance is when something vibrates in response to something else. So we talked about these 400 different relationships from the heavens, right? Well, that's what's happening up there. What happens down here is, in a sense, the ocean basins of the world hear these relationships as if they're notes or beats or pulses. And the ocean basins, each one has a different kind of characteristic that responds to any one of those notes or calls from the heavens in a different way. And that's called resonance.
Talking of the resonance in the ocean, you have a wonderful description of how they all interact with each other.
Yes, I was walking through Oceanographic Institute with an oceanographer in the Bay of Fundy, a man named Charlie O'Reilly. And he said, well, it's like having a table. And if you fill the table with pans, all different sizes, shapes, some deep, some shallow, and then fill them with water, even at different levels, some all the way up, some just low. And then if you start kicking the table with a rhythm, right? And that kicking, by the way, is a force from the heavens. You know, again, it might be the full moon. And those pans will respond differently to the kicking. Some pans will be very excited, and some pans not so much. And then you also have to remember, because they're touching, they influence each other.
It's a wonderful image because obviously you realize that the tide comes in and then it bounces off the shore and then maybe it hits an island or it hits a reef or it hits the next continent.
Yes, absolutely. There are vibrations that happen in Europe that find their way all the way over, you know, thousands and thousands of miles, and they show up on another coast. That is absolutely true. The tide, you know, it's a large wave that travels at 450 miles per hour around the Earth. When it hits continents, it reflects, it refracts, it folds back on itself, it slows down, it speeds up. I mean, it's mind-boggling how complex it gets.
In your book, you write about the many scholars throughout history from ancient times who've tried to unravel these mysteries. How did the Enlightenment change our understanding of this, given that this goes back to the Greeks and indeed, I presume, to the Phoenicians and Babylonians too?
Yes. For most of human history, 99% of human history, we had a very, very different view of the heavens, right? We obviously observed it. And in fact, the earlier observers were called priests or astrologers, and they kept very precise information about the relationships of what was going on up there, eclipses and so forth. But they didn't know how it worked. They might look up at the moon and wonder, how does she do it? How does she reach out silently and invisibly over all that distance and stir the waters of the earth? I mean, nobody knew this, right? But they speculated. I mean, some people thought the moon did it by heating rocks on the bottom of the ocean. And when those rocks were really hot, the water would boil and swell, and that was high tide. And then when the moon went away, those rocks cooled, and that was low tide. And some people thought it was the breathing of a large beast or the breathing of the earth itself. Even Leonardo da Vinci in the 13th century thought that it must be the breathing of a large beast, and he tried to calculate the size of its lung. Yeah. And on our coast, actually just up the coast from where I am, high tide woman made the high tide by lifting her skirt. And then during the scientific revolution, culminating with Newton, we really radically changed that view of the heavens, because gravity until then was just an inherent nature inside any object or person that caused it to fall. In fact, Kepler, the German scientist, said, gravity is soul. It's the soul of something that makes it want to go back to Earth. It was the soul of the apple that made it want it to fall. And of course, Newton changed all that and gave us the laws of planetary motion and gravity. And again, that's when we started to get our foothold. But even Descartes, who's, of course, a French philosopher, a natural historian, they wanted to get away from gravity. You know, these new scientists wanted to leave the ancient world behind. And they couldn't stand the idea of gravity because it was this black magic, invisible force that did not fit with the new world. But in the end, they reluctantly had to plunk it right in the middle of their theory.
Well, I have to say that gravity is still so mysterious that I can believe that there's a woman who lifts her skirts and that's how the tides come and go just as easily as I can believe in gravity.
Yeah, yeah.
So your book is quite a travelogue and an adventure story, quite apart from going aground. You follow surfers in search of monster waves and you go in search of tidal bores. Tell me about tidal bores and the one you watched in China.
Yes, that's a tidal bore on the Chentong River. And a tidal bore is when the tide comes up the river in a form of a wave or a solid wall of water. There might be 100 of them around the world, in the Bay of Fundy, up in the Cook Inlet in Alaska. The Amazon River has a large one. But the tidal bore on the Chentong River in China, which is just south of Shanghai and near Hangzhou, is the largest in the world. It gets up to 25 feet tall. And it comes in on every tide, twice a day, every day. The first tide chart in the world that we know of came out of that place. And it was to log when the tidal bore showed up. And it was etched in stone in the 10th century. And it was probably a couple hundred years before the first tidal chart appeared in the West for the London Bridge in 1200.
You've talked about these great tides, and I was actually struck by the fact that in the past, people have used tides for power. I'd like you to read a passage from your book, please, if you wouldn't mind. It's on page 230. Can you explain the context for it?
Yes. I think that people don't often realize how long we've been using tide energy, actually. There are thousands of them around Europe. And on the east coast of the United States, particularly in the northern part there, we had hundreds of tide mills that started around 1620 and lasted all the way through the mid-1800s, milling lumber and making paper and fashioning copper. And there is one tide mill, the oldest in the world, that is south of London in Southampton and actually in the village of Ealing, that is still operating and they still make flour. And I went there and I got lucky. One of the tide millers invited me to help him with a tide cycle. And so that's the context for this piece of writing. Laboring at first, the wheel eventually rumbled to speed. The whole place seemed to come alive, creaking and groaning like a ship at sea. Windows shook, iron latches and levers rattled, a spoon and pencil chattered in a jam jar. Upstairs, the grist bin's tick, tick, tick confirmed that grain was being fed to the grinding stones. When I looked up from the swishing and gurgling water wheel, a stream of golden flour was pouring from the chute. The water wheel ran for 4.5 hours. Through the windows, I watched the tide disappear from the harbor, leaving all the boats aground. The mill's wheel wash gushed into the estuary like a whitewater rapid. A fine powder had filled the air as soon as we started producing flour, settling on everything, including our eyebrows and eyelashes. The place smelled like baking bread, hot grease, and low tide.
It's a wonderful bit of writing. It's wonderfully descriptive. Finally, we know that sea level's rising due to global warming. So what can we expect from the tides in the future, or do we just not know?
There's a lot of it that we don't know, but we do know that if sea level rises 3 feet in the next 50 years, which is a conservative estimate, there will be a lot of people and communities that will have to move. And I think one of the things that is important to understand is that sea level isn't level. I mean, we're taught in kindergarten that water seeks its own level, and it may, but it doesn't find it in the ocean. For example, where I live on the Pacific, the trade winds push the water across the ocean westward, and it piles up in Asia and the South Pacific. So that level over there is 2 feet higher than it is against my coast. And the Pacific is about a foot higher than the Atlantic. And the Atlantic slopes from Florida up to New England. Also, we know that land is changing, right? Some land is rebounding from the last glacial age, lifting, and some land is sinking. The tides happen on top of all that. And if we hearken back to that conversation about resonance, as the sea levels change, it changes the basin's natural frequency of vibration. So that's where we're going to have the major changes in tides. And we could see larger tides in some places. And in fact, we could see lesser tides in others as sea level rises.
Jonathan White is a marine conservationist, sailor, surfer, and author of the book Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Thanks very much for spending time with me today.
Thank you, Helen. I really appreciate it.